When we look out at the universe, we see that it is full of sources of light. Within our own Milky Way, there are hundreds of billions of stars. And beyond our Milky Way, there are trillions of galaxies out there in the universe to explore. Throughout all of them, there are stars, small, low-mass ones, large, high-mass ones, and stars like our sun and all the others in between. But despite the fact that we approximate them as steady, unwavering, continuous sources of light, it turns out that all stars are intrinsically variable. They have properties that cause them to change over time. And some of the ways in which these stars vary are absolutely fascinating and hold lessons not only for our own star system, but for stars all throughout the universe. Find out more on this edition of the Starts With a Bang podcast. When it comes to understanding stars, there are many different things you look at. You can look at a star's brightness over time. You can look at the polarization of its light, which can tell you some information about the magnetism of the star and the magnetic fields present throughout it. You can also look at ejecta, at changes in temperature, at changes to a star's spectrum, at sunspots on other stars, which I guess we would call star spots and not sunspots. And here to help us put all of this together and help us understand how stars like and different from our sun vary, I'm so pleased to welcome Dr. Lyra Tsao to our podcast. Lyra got her PhD from The Ohio State University and is currently a VITA postdoctoral fellow at the University of Vanderbilt. Lyra, I'm so pleased to have you here, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ethan.
Yeah, I'm really excited. So you first hit my radar at this past January's American Astronomical Society meeting. I know you gave a dissertation talk. I know you gave a press conference, and that was where I said, oh, wow. Her stuff is really interesting. I have to have her on the podcast. So tell me, this idea that we sort of naively had about, oh, stars should be relatively continuous, they should be relatively unvarying over time. What's wrong with that picture? If that's the picture we have in our head for stars, what are we omitting? What are we missing out on?
So part of this picture that we're starting to get from all these space-based ground-based observations is that stars are actually quite surprising. And a lot of the data that we previously thought were fit very easily by these very simple models are turning out to be wrong in surprising places. And some of these discrepancies actually point to really interesting other physics that is relevant for these stars, and actually points to things that are important for our own sun as well.
Well, that's sort of interesting. So can you give me an example? Let's say I went and modeled the sun as something that just gives off a continuous stream of energy with no variations, with no magnetic field on it, and with no sunspots that ever formed on it. If I were to model that for the sun, how wrong would I be? What sort of phenomena would I miss out on if I made that approximation here? And then can you go a step further and tell me how this shows up on other stars in the universe?
So actually, as it turns out, a lot of the processes that we think of as being important for the formation of planets and for the evolution of life, for instance, have to do with interactions between the sun and the Earth. And, you know, not only today, but in the past, and way, way, way into the past. And so the evolution of activity, in particular the solar wind, the amount of UV light and X-ray light that the sun gives out, all of these are sensitive functions to processes in the exterior of the star, which are driven by the magnetic fields and all these different physics that we don't account for in standard models.
So the first thing it sounds like you're saying I'd miss out on is the fact that stars evolve significantly over time in terms of not only their energy output, but also in terms of their particle output, which you call the solar wind, and also in terms of their spectral energy density, or how much of their light is in various parts of the spectrum, like X-ray, ultraviolet, visible, infrared, etc.
Right. And one of the pictures that in stellar astrophysics, I think, is starting to emerge, is that we're starting to look at stars holistically. So previously, whereas stars were thought of as kind of these stable, unchanging objects for millions and billions of years, we are starting to understand that the star's rotation, the star's angular momentum content, the star's magnetism, and all these things are related. In particular, the stellar wind actually changes the rotation of the star, and those particles that fly off actually change how much angular momentum content you have in star. And all these things are linked, so that the amount of material you get off the star is also the amount of material that you start driving in your stellar wind.
Now that's kind of interesting. I had never put those two aspects together. So for example, our star, the sun, rotates so slowly. I know it has a differential rotation where I think the equator rotates at a different speed than the poles. And I think it takes about 25 Earth days for the equator to make one complete rotation, but 33 days for the polar regions to make a complete rotation. I had always sort of approximated that as, you know what, this is a slow rotator. Of all of the spherical objects that we know of on Earth and in the solar system, I think the sun is the most spherical thing that we know of because of how slowly it rotates. I think it's something like one part in a million departure from a perfect sphere. It's so excellently spherical. And yet you're telling me that the sun's rotation is important because of the relationship between rotation rate, which is the main form of angular momentum in the sun, and the solar wind, which seems surprising to me, because over the entire history of the sun, it's emitted a very small amount of mass relative to its actual overall mass via the solar wind. I think if I added it all up over the 4.5 billion years our sun has been around, that the sun has maybe only emitted a couple of Earth masses worth of material in the solar wind throughout over all of its history. And you're actually telling me that the relationship between a star like the sun's rotation rate and overall angular momentum is dramatically related to the solar wind. How does that work? Can you explain that for us?
A lot of this field is currently in active research. And so the simple answer is that we don't really know. We don't have sensitive statistics on exactly how mass loss rates and, you know, the stellar wind in particular is related to some of these properties. But we think it has something to do with the generic activity of the star. And so the scenario that I'm telling you about is most relevant for these rapidly rotating stars that are significantly younger than the sun. And for these stars, where they're rotating so rapidly and so magnetic, they can be orders of magnitude more magnetic and more spotted than the sun. So the sun is what we'd consider a more inactive star. on the threshold of what we think it takes to actually generate any kind of dynamo. It's kind of on the threshold of what we think it takes to generate a dynamo in these solar type stars. But in the more active stars, they can be significantly more spotted. Some of these stars are so spotted that they're actually more spot than star. They can be covered by 50, 80% spots. And in those cases, that's a very dramatically different state for a star to be in. And investigating those cases tells us a lot about our models of stellar physics.
Now that's incredibly impressive, because I remember back in 2012, this is already 11 years ago, I got to watch the transit of Venus. And to those of you who missed the 2012 transit of Venus, I got bad news. There isn't going to be another one until the 22nd century. So either hop in your relativistic time machine or hope you live a very, very long life if you want to see it again. But I remember there were sunspots on the sun during this transit of Venus. And Venus itself is small. I think it blocks less than 1% of the total area of the sun's disk when it transits in front of it from our point of view. And Venus was far bigger than any of the sunspots I saw on our sun at that time. Now, you're telling me there are stars out there that are 50 to 80% covered in sunspots, where sunspots are typically regions where you're talking about a tremendous temperature dip of up to thousands of degrees cooler than the rest of the star, and that maybe if our sun was a little younger, maybe a little smaller, a little cooler, and rotated just a little bit faster, that it might have been a more active star with enormous, basically continent size or planet size or even Jupiter size star spots on it?
Right, exactly. I think that's a picture that's emerging in the field, is that large portions of these stars are actually covered by these extremely magnetic regions. And these detections have been made in detail and with multiple different methods. So it appears to be a robust feature of some of these more active stars. And so we have to confront, I think, the reality that the sun may have been significantly more active in its past. And we have to understand what kinds of implications these observations have for our understanding of stellar evolution.
Yeah, that sounds really fascinating. You've got me thinking now, and I apologize because I'm a theorist by training, and so this is where my mind just always goes. I try and think about what's the physical mechanism that can be causing this. If I compare something like planet Earth to the sun, both of them have a magnetic field. I think the magnetic field strength of the sun near the surface of the sun is pretty close to the strength of the magnetic field of Earth near the surface of Earth. But on Earth, we have a magnet that our magnetic field basically behaves like a dipole. We have a metallic core that is rotating, and we think it's the rotation of the inner and maybe even the liquid outer core, which is magnetic and has charged particles in it and spins around relatively quickly. We think that that must be driving the magnetic field of our planet, which looks like it's a bar magnet inside. It has a north magnet close to our north pole. It has a south magnet close to the south pole. And, you know, if you look at the magnetic field lines on Earth, they're roughly uniform over the surface of the Earth, which is why your compass needles always deflect to north. The sun isn't like that at all. The sun has a really irregular magnetic field, and it's the cause of where you have these magnetic fields lines breaking apart and reconnecting with one another, that's the mechanism, as far as I know, that launches our space weather. Things like solar flares and coronal mass ejections and you know, strengthenings of the solar wind. Are you telling me that it's plausible that around stars that are smaller, lower in mass, less evolved, cooler, and rotate much more quickly than the sun, maybe that last aspect is the most important, that they actually might have more coherent magnetic fields that create enormous star spots on them? Is there a supposed relationship there between rotation rate and the overall magnetic field of the star?
Yes. So when we look at dynamos that are different from our sun, we actually track a lot of different properties. So not only is the field strength something that we care about, that refers to how strong the magnetic field is, we care about its complexity, how much of it is due to that, you know, simple dipole component, how much is it, you know, higher order, like a quadrupole or greater. And we care about the geometric distribution of where these, how these dynamos are shaped as well. And the picture is actually quite, it differs quite a lot with the kind of star that you're looking at. So stars that are significantly more massive and stars that are significantly less massive than the sun actually act in surprising ways compared to the mean, the standard way that magnetism is generated on the sun. And this has to do with the interior structure of the star.
So that's really interesting to think about, because I don't really think about stars as being differentiated the way, say, a planet like Earth is differentiated. I think of them as, okay, well, I've got the core of the star where fusion occurs, and that's where I get temperatures of about 4 million Kelvin and up. And then outside of that, I've got this radiative zone where photons bounce around and basically take random walks to get to the surface that last maybe 100,000 years or so. And then you've got that outer photosphere where, you know, photons get released out into the universe. But it makes sense to think, well, you're going to have a turbulent environment in there. You're going to have rotation. You're going to have charged particles moving around because it's a plasma, because it's hot enough to all be ionized in there. And so you're going to generate electric currents and magnetic fields. And maybe you're going to have some complex behaviors in there. And are you saying that it's these interior motions of charged particles in the star that are causing these surface features of star spots that can engulf large portions of the star, that relationship is the key thing to investigate and disentangle?
Right. So there's a distinct, I think, departure between stars of different interiors. And that's a point I want to kind of raise here, is that the process that we've been talking about, these dynamo motions and the motions in the that are generated by churning motions, the energy generated by churning motions, and the magnetic fields generated by these churning motions, operate in stars that have these churning regions on the exterior. These are known as convective regions. But for stars at significantly higher mass, they actually do not have significant, large convective envelopes. They largely have radiative envelopes, and the convective region is in the interior. So for many of those stars, we think that those magnetic fields are not generated by dynamo action, but rather they seem to be more linked to a field that once existed and still remains in the core, so a so-called fossil field. At the low mass end, the difference between a star that has a radiative region underneath the convective region, such as our sun, and a star at still lower mass, which is a fully convective star, where even the core is convective. The difference between those two classes of objects is still also an active field of research, and people are now trying to reconcile what dynamo models do at the interface between those two classes of models.
That's really interesting, and we're going to get into the details of convection right after we pause for this message about our sponsor. I'd like to thank our sponsor of this podcast, Avenues Online. Today's episode of the Starts With a Bang podcast is brought to you by Avenues Online, the virtual campus of Avenues, the World School. Avenues Online is an accredited Tier 1 private school designed for students from toddler through 12th grade who want to pursue a world-class education freed from the constraints of a physical school. Learn alongside peers living on 6 continents and in more than 20 countries with a global faculty leading the way. You can learn more at avenues.org/SWAB. And now back to our program. So Lyra, are you telling me, when I think of the difference between convective and radiative, when I think radiative, I'm just like, okay, you've got like a hot part on the inside and a cold part on the outside, and we're just going to allow heat to sort of diffuse from the inside out, and then it'll reach the outermost part and radiate away out into the universe. Whereas when I think of convection, I think, okay, well, it's hot at the bottom or towards the center, and it's cold towards the top. And, you know, just like in a pot of water that you heat from underneath, the cold stuff at the top precipitates down while the hot stuff from the bottom rises up. And so you get these large I won't say circular, but you get these sort of cyclical motions where the inside part that's hot rises and the outside part that's cold falls down, and you get these sort of large-scale motions inside. Now, are you saying that this is not necessarily driven by either temperature or active magnetism that's currently being generated, but you can actually take these old, at least in hot, massive stars, you can take these old magnetic fields that were sort of imprinted some time ago, maybe even by a dynamo mechanism that's no longer present, and those magnetic field lines get trapped, they get frozen into the material, and then when the material convects, these magnetic field lines, they get all tangled up, and when they break and reconnect, that can cause some sort of, I would guess, complex stellar behavior?
So I just want to be careful and say that most of the stuff that I work on and most of the stuff that we're talking about in this program are the cool stars. These are the ones that are solar type and have dynamo-driven fields. And so the massive stars have really interesting magnetic effects, you know, fossil fields in those stars. But I don't think there's really been I think it's been inconclusive, and actually I think there's been arguments made against the idea that there are any kind of star spots on those kinds of stars.
Okay, so you're saying the big spotted ones are are the cool ones. And I'll be honest, I don't even think of the sun as a cool star. To me, a cool star is like you're an M dwarf or worse. Like your maybe maximum temperature, I think, is like 3000 Kelvin at the surface, as opposed to the sun, which is more like 6000 Kelvin at the edge of the photosphere. But when you say cool stars, how cool are we talking, and what sorts of stellar masses does that correspond to?
Right. So we're talking about stars that are roughly in your regime. So this is like the F stars all the way down to the M stars, and something similar to solar mass to significantly lower.
Are you talking all the way down to like the limit of where the line between a star and a brown dwarf is, like around 0.08, 0.075 solar masses?
The situation gets a bit more complicated there, but I don't think in many of those objects, actually cloud formation becomes important in the atmosphere. And so we have to be careful in establishing the bounds of the kinds of stars that we're talking about today. But I'd be comfortable talking about M dwarfs all the way down to the fully convective M dwarfs.
Okay, so you're basically only excluding like the most massive 3% or so of stars that form. And then you're going to exclude like the lowest mass red dwarfs, the ones that are close to the border of being brown dwarfs. But pretty much any star that I think of as like, well, it's kind of similar in mass to the sun. It's kind of similar in overall lifetime to the sun. You know, we're talking a broad range of stellar masses, stellar sizes, and stellar temperatures. We're just sort of not talking about the ultra high mass or the ultra low mass end.
Yes, this is a general effect of many stars. And actually, so a lot of the really interesting effects that we're talking about are not fed back into stellar evolution. And so we talked about the process of convection, but it might come as a surprise that these magnetic processes and these star spots, these cooler regions, these inhomogeneous regions in stars, actually feed back into the structure solutions. So you can actually have your star be meaningfully wrongly described by a standard model if it's sufficiently magnetic, because the process of actually making a spot means that there's a region which is stable against convection and the material can't get through. And so some of these effects are actually important in greater detail as well.
Now this is kind of interesting to me, because I'm remembering back to my stellar evolution days, and I apologize to everyone who ever tried to teach me this at how poorly I understood it. But if I remember, when you talk about a star like our sun, we talk about it as though the stuff that's in the core right now stays there. That core material won't be driven out of the core and distributed among the rest of the star, and new material that still might be very hydrogen rich isn't getting drawn into the core. In other words, the fusion, the nuclear fusion reactions that power the star that happen in the core, we're saying they stay in the core. And then when the core runs out of hydrogen, our star is going to move on to the next stage of stellar evolution, swell, become a red giant, engage hydrogen shell burning, and then helium core burning. and that all of that hydrogen from outside of the core isn't ever going to make it in there. Now, as I recall, except for the absolute lowest mass stars, those M-dwarf stars that we're talking about, those are the only ones that we talk about as being fully convective, that they're going to cycle material in and out of the core and wind up burning all of the hydrogen in their star eventually. When you talk about that there are these magnetic fields, there are these convective regions, does that maybe change our picture somewhat when we talk about how stars are going to live and die over their lifetimes?
Yes, in fact it does. The convective suppression that occurs as a result of magnetism and star spots actually changes materially the solution for the star. So one effect that actually is really important right now that we're seeing a lot of evidence for is an effect called radius inflation. And it turns out that these strong magnetic fields and these star spot complexes on stars puff up stars at low mass. And most of these stars at low mass and, you know, in the Milky Way are relatively young from their dynamo perspective. So even though they're old, they're still rotating very rapidly. They haven't had a chance to shed a lot of that angular momentum. And so they're still very, very, very active. And so a lot of these active stars are not being modeled very well because of this radius inflation effect that the stellar models are simply not, the stellar models that do not include the effects of magnetism and spots are not telling us what the star's actual properties are. There's a discrepancy, which is this radius inflation effect, between what you would actually measure the stellar radius to be and what you would predict it to be.
Now that's a surprise to me, because I had learned that the radius of a star is pretty much solely determined by its mass and where it is in terms of the stages of stellar evolution. So are you telling me if I took a star that was just like the sun, same mass, same age, but instead of rotating as slowly as it is, I allowed the rotation to speed up. I sped up the rotation of my star, that I would reach a point relatively quickly where I wouldn't just see, oh, there's a little bulge at the equator and there's a little more flattening at the poles. You're telling me that the radius of the entire star could dramatically be different, that if this star were rotating more quickly by a sufficient amount, it would all of a sudden exhibit what you call radius inflation, that it would just have the same mass and the same properties, but due to its faster rotation and allegedly a greater magnetic dynamo effect at various places inside, that it would swell, it would just become a larger star?
Yes, I think, obviously it's hard to say with any particular case, you know, astronomy is primarily an observational science, and that we can't go and take the sun and spin it up ourselves. But we do see in studies of these eclipsing binaries and in studies of these low mass stars that the stars genuinely are puffed up relative to what you would expect them to be, given their composition, as you said, and given their mass. And we know the masses of these eclipsing binaries super, super well. So this is just a discrepancy between standard models that do not include magnetism. And it points to the need for additional development in the field for these magnetic models. And these kinds of effects, which affect radius and other properties, are important because when we look at, for instance, exoplanets and these downstream parameters, they often depend on the stellar radius. And so we have to be really clear that we understand what goes into that measurement and what goes and how we can predict such models with such observations as well, in order to understand how to better model.
That's really both fascinating and surprising. So one of the things that I had learned, and I've always thought it was controversial, and I think there are at least some people who think it's controversial, is that red dwarf star, these M-class stars, this lowest mass class of star, would be terrible candidates for having planets with life on them. Because these stars are so active and they flare so frequently, and they're not, you know, stable over time the way that a star like our sun is. But are you telling me that if we found a set of red dwarf stars that were basically slow enough rotators, that maybe didn't have large numbers of star spots on them, that didn't have significant magnetic activity occurring in their interiors, that maybe all of those things we've been saying about red dwarf stars wouldn't apply to that class of red dwarf star, that it's really only the ones that, you know, exhibit this varying behavior, that exhibit these magnetic properties within them, that are the ones that we say, okay, well, those are reasons to disfavor life around those particular stars, but that might not mean this applies to all stars of that class?
Right. So I think you're touching on a very interesting idea, which is that perhaps it's not the time yet for red dwarf stars, because all the red dwarf stars that we see, almost all of them, are still very active and still very young. But imagine what would happen to them in billions of years, or even in some cases trillions of years, as they shed their angular momenta through stellar winds. What would happen to the interior dynamo? I think that's still a very active question, and a very big open question, is whether or not those stars can actually be turn out to be inactive in the future. And of course, whether or not that would have any implications for the prevalence of life, maybe billions or trillions of years in the future. I think depends to some degree on that question. But it's a very keen observation, I think, to make that all of the existing studies that kind of discount these red dwarf stars have to do with the idea that all these stars are simply active, that we see around us. And so our perception of these stars is very active and flaring. Might be related to that in part.
That's a really interesting suggestion. I hadn't really considered that before, but it sounds like, if I put the pieces together correctly, that what you're suggesting is maybe right now is a great time in the universe for Earth-like planets, for planets that are about Earth size, that orbit around stars that are similar to the sun, that are rotating slowly, that have shed their initial angular momentum to become slow rotators with relatively small sunspots and relatively non-catastrophic magnetic field changes inside of them. Maybe now's a great time for life to be emerging, and maybe even complex, differentiated, intelligent life to be emerging on worlds like our own. But that the majority of stars in the universe, the red dwarf stars, because they're so much longer lived than the sun, even the red dwarf stars that have been around for 10 billion years or more, this is still their infancy. This is still the first 1% or less of their life, and that if you wait tens of billions of years or hundreds of billions of years, or as you said, in some cases, trillions or maybe even tens of trillions of years, that these red dwarf stars may indeed shed enough angular momentum via their solar winds, via their stellar winds, to become slow rotators, become more stable, become less inhospitable for life. And then maybe a long time from now, maybe those will be the planets where life emerges and thrives and becomes something interesting. Maybe we're biased against them because we haven't been around for long enough to watch those stellar evolutionary changes occur.
Exactly. And I do want to add a caveat that we still know vanishingly little about magnetic processes around these low-mass stars. So maybe, in fact, there's a wrinkle in this idea that means that, you know, maybe those stars never actually reach a point of low activity. But I think the point remains that we're simply observing these stars and these systems in a state where they're still very active. And maybe this is not the full picture.
Well, let's go back in time, if we can, and let's try and imagine the solar system as it was in its infancy, back when the sun was very young, only a few hundred million years or maybe even younger than that. What do you think would have been the major differences between our sun back then versus the sun today? I assume it would be a little bit cooler. I assume that it would be a little bit fainter. I assume that it would be a little bit smaller, but maybe that's not right anymore. What do we think the sun could have been like in the past? And how could those past differences have sort of changed conditions from maybe a conventional expectation?
Right. So a lot of the stuff that I'm talking about affects stars in kind of a mass-dependent fashion. And so it really depends on the rotation rate. And so for a star that is super low mass, it might affect them for a very, very long time, that the magnetic processes are very important for the stellar structure. For the sun, for slower type stars, I don't think it ends up affecting it for an incredible amount of time. But detailed models, I think, will be necessary to reconcile the magnetic inflation scenario with past observations of the sun. What we do know that there has been recent evidence for is, you know, we've talked about the M dwarfs, we've talked about kind of the higher mass stars, the stars that are OB and A type stars. Now I want to kind of bring attention to stars that are slightly lower in mass than the sun. These are the K dwarfs. But they're slightly higher in mass than the M dwarfs. And in some of these stars have been argued as these prime habitability targets by a lot of studies. That there's this kind of that several different advantages exist in. And so, in K-dwarfs, some interesting physical mechanisms appear to be operating, and we seem to be seeing some imprints and some signatures of the interactions, and this is very cutting-edge research, between the interplay of angular momenta in the interior of the star and its activity, which seems to be a lot longer than previously estimated.
Well, that's pretty interesting. I wanna ask you about two different things then. So One thing I want to ask you about is the relationship between the activity period of a star and its overall lifetime. My general rule is I like to bastardize a quote from Blade Runner. In Blade Runner, the mad scientist who is behind a lot of what goes on in Blade Runner, he gives the lesson that the flame that burns twice as bright lives just half as long. And for stars, the situation's worse than that. If I took a star like the sun and I compared it to a star that was twice as massive of the sun, I would find that the star that's twice as massive doesn't burn twice as bright. It burns more like 8 times as bright. But as a result, it only lives about 1/8 as long. Well, you're saying let's look at these K stars, these K-class stars that are less massive than the sun, but more massive than the red dwarf stars that are the most common type of star. Those are about half the sun's mass. Well, if they're about half the sun's mass, then that means that instead of a lifetime of 10 to 12 billion years like our sun, they're going to have a lifetime of like 80 to 100 billion years. Can we look at the K stars that we know, the older K stars, the intermediate age K stars, the young K stars, and can we say anything about how long it may take some K stars to go from this early star spot rich complex magnetic field, fast rotating state to a state where they've shed enough of their angular momentum that they've settled down into being, you know, more stable places?
I think that the recent surprise in the literature is that many of these K-dwarfs are actually active for far longer than previously predicted by their standard rotation activity relations. And so we think a lot of these dynamos in stars, in low mass stars, are related to the angular momentum content of the star. And so if you're spinning rapidly, you expect that to drive these star spot complexes and these strong surface magnetic fields. But in the limit of slow rotation, you would expect that stars then stop being so active and start settling down. For a subset of these K-dwarfs, it seems that they're active for maybe even billions of years longer than expected. And so it's very important, I think, to start investigating whether or not this enhanced activity really exists in these stars and what we need to do to account for these anomalous activity enhancements in our stellar models.
I mean, it definitely sounds like we're missing something, doesn't it? It sounds like, you know, the simple models that you obviously want to make, the simple models where you say like, okay, this is the star's mass when it's born, this is how fast the star's spinning when it's born, and therefore, this is the evolutionary path we expect it'll take. If you don't get the same answers between stars of the same mass and the same age with similar rotation rates, that's got to tell you something more than just those factors is at play. Something else has to be at least partially responsible for their behavior.
Right, and one really interesting discovery in the field in recent years has been the idea of rotational stalling. And these refer to a period of hundreds of millions to billions of years in some of these stars where they appear to not change in their stellar rotation. So this is to say that if you measured the star's rotation over time, that it would seemingly stay still for quite a long time for billions of years, perhaps. And at the same time, we seem to be seeing that these stars are enhanced in their activity, that they stay extremely active. And so, that they seem to be significantly more active than expected for that rotation rate. And so you can imagine the picture that as a star evolves, it kind of spins down at this predictable rate. And then there's this period that we think now exists. There's some observational evidence for it, where it just seems to stop in place. And its activity seems to be very active, and it seems to be very magnetic. And so there's been a class of models that seems to be favored by this hypothesis, which has to do with how the interior actually can drive an additional dynamo process and reinvigorate the surface at the expense of the core's rotation. So you're not seeing the surface rotation change, but actually kind of like a fidget spinner, or kind of not like a fidget spinner, the interaction between the core and the envelope seems to be the kind of mechanism that might be responsible for this strange period in stellar evolution.
You know, now you've got me thinking about case stars, like I think about young people, that, okay, some of them might look like they're grown-ups on the outside, but they still have the maturity of a child. They still have sort of that internal state that hasn't grown up yet. And for some people, this can continue all the way into early adulthood. Whereas other people, it seems like they're mature and, you know, have an adult mindset from even when they're a teenager. And it sounds like you're sort of telling me maybe K-stars are a little bit like this, that, you know, you look at them and you're like, oh yeah, you're all roughly the same age and you have roughly the same lifetime. But depending on not just their surface rotation rate, but on internal properties that maybe we can't even see, some of them are going to exhibit this very mature behavior where they don't have lots of star spots and they don't have many active flares and violent activity, and maybe they don't need to shed any more angular momentum to reach that sort of adult state of their life. But other K-stars, even ones that might look mature on the outside, are actually still at this complex roiling, boiling state on the inside, and they are going to need more time in order to reach full maturity. Is that an absurd analogy, or is there maybe something to that?
Yeah, I think the picture that we're evolving to in the field of stellar astrophysics that's enabled by these observations is we're starting to be able to understand the interactions within stars and between some of these really interesting physical effects, such as magnetism and rotation, in great detail. So we're starting to include a lot of these additional physics in our models, and we're finding that perhaps some of these physics might be implicated in detail and actually have a significant effect on the star in terms of radius inflation, in terms of these long stalls in their angular momentum evolution, long apparent stalls in their angular momentum evolution, and in these periods of deviation from standard activity relations. And so we're starting to fit all the little places where our standard models don't really fit, and we're starting to gain a much fuller appreciation for the physics of all these models.
So let me ask you now to bring it back to things that we can observe? Because you've been talking on one hand about how astronomy is an observational science, and where, you know, you can't do experiments with your stars, you just have to observe the ones that you can see, and infer the rest. But you've also been talking about how a lot of the behavior that we see, it has to be driven by internal processes that we can't see. So if I was someone who was saying, well, how would I go about validating my model? How would I go about sort of determining whether these proposed mechanisms are actually at play or not? What are some methods I could use? Could I, for example, look at the stars of a certain stellar classification within a star cluster where I know all of the stars are the same age? And could I learn something by comparing that with stars of a different cluster's age? For example, if I look at the stars in the Pleiades, I know they're roughly all about 80 million years old. If I look at the stars in the cluster Messier 67, if I have that right, I think they're all about 4 billion years old. Can I do this? Can I look at stars of the same type in different clusters, measure their properties, and learn something about what might be going on in their interiors?
Right. So of stars at different ages, understanding how their properties change is very important to confront the observations with models. That's a very important approach. And what we're starting to get at is we're starting to see a lot of these stellar parameters that we're getting for stars are telling us very very subtle clues about how stellar evolution occurs. So stuff like stellar rotation, which was really pioneered by the Kepler satellite, getting a stellar rotation for enormous sample of stars, and you know is we currently have the TESS satellite to give us a significant number of rotation periods all sky. A lot of that is really important for investigating these supposed stalls and some of these interesting lines of argument. There have been processes to determine the magnetic fields around these stars. These are generally techniques that depend on the Zeeman effect, and these are approaches which care very much about how active the star is, how magnetic it is, and you can actually see imprints of their magnetism on the light itself. This is generally how people look at those effects. And a part of what I did for my PhD thesis, and which I continue to do, is actually trying to model the light from the star as coming from two separate components. So the inhomogeneous surface of the star is emitting perhaps at two different temperatures. And if you posit that you're actually seeing emission from the star spot and from the star itself, the regions outside of the star spot, then you might actually be able to fit and obtain the star spot signal of these stars. And since star spots are very closely related to magnetism, this is also kind of a magnetic proxy that you can use to investigate how magnetic stars are. But the thing I want to talk about to peer deeply inside stars is an approach called astroseismology. And, you know, I'll turn it back to you, but astroseismology is a very powerful tool to actually understand the interiors of these stars. And perhaps at some point in the future, it might be our way of directly testing whether or not this core envelope hypothesis is actually occurring in large samples of stars.
You know, this is extremely interesting. You talked about how, you know, when you look at a star, it isn't a perfect black body that you can, you know, just model it by, oh, it has a certain temperature and that's the temperature everywhere on the surface. And that's the light we see. Even if we try to do that for our own sun, we're gonna misestimate a bunch of things, because the sun, even if you ignored all the sunspots, is not a perfect black body. It's more like a series of black bodies all superimposed on each other, because the very outer layer of the photosphere versus layers that are a little further down but whose light still emitted, they're at different temperatures. So in reality, if you want to model the sun more accurately, you have to treat it like it's a sum of a bunch of different black bodies and assign the right weights and percentages to the different temperatures you're considering. Then you throw sunspots in, and sunspots come in with different temperatures. They appear dark because they're lower temperature, but you'll notice if you look at the sun and you see various sunspots that the temperature difference is not uniform across the sunspot, that different sunspots might have different temperature drops. I imagine that same, you know, that same sort of set of features exists on all stars with star spots on them. But then you throw in this extra feature of astroseismology. And when I think of astroseismology, I think, oh, these are star quakes, just like Earth has earthquakes, which is basically, I think of this for better or worse, as Earth is a complex layer cake of various components. And when you get an earthquake, that is some part of the Earth rearranging its interior masses. The interior mass distribution of the Earth rearranges itself. You get an earthquake, and as a result of that, a number of things happen, one of which is Earth's rotation rate changes slightly. I imagine that when you consider astroseismology, it's roughly the same thing, except you're talking about the interior of a star and components rearranging. And so I don't really know what the observables are that come out when you have a star quake or when you're studying astroseismology. But I imagine that understanding the temperature of your star and modeling it correctly, understanding star spot coverage and the underlying link to magnetism within the star, and astroseismology can all give us a window into the internal processes happening inside one of these stars. I'll turn it over to you and ask, okay, but how? How do we put those three pieces of the star's temperature and spectrum, of star spots and the underlying magnetic field, and star quakes or astroseismology, how do those pieces all fit together?
Yeah, so it's I keep coming back to the idea, which is that we're probing stellar interiors in detail. And when I'm talking about stellar interiors in detail, it relates to how different zones within the star can affect, you know, these kind of more global properties. And since we're observational in astronomy, and we tend to be these kinds of detectives almost, and so any kind of information that we can glean out of all these different observations proves very useful in fitting our models. And so astroseismology, which I like to think of as kind of the ringing of a tuning fork, or the pulsation or the ringing of a bell, for instance, these are modes that you can detect on the star. It's not so much that things are changing from time to time, but it tells you something about its interior structure. So you can imagine if the interior structure were solid, that it would have a vastly different set of pulsational modes than if the star was fully concentrated at one point and the rest were relatively diffuse. And so the internal distribution of matter within the star matters. And also, as it turns out, these stars have different interior structure components. There are zones that we mentioned were radiative and convective, and the interplay between these zones there exist modes that can propagate through only the convective region, and there exist modes that propagate only through the radiative region. And so you might be able to actually say something about how the interior matter is distributed within the star by looking at its pulsation. And the way that we actually derive astroseismic signals from stars is that we stare at them for very long periods of time. We look for minute changes in the light coming from the star. And so the star will actually be a tiny bit brighter and then a tiny bit fainter. And this signal, when you process it in the frequency domain, actually gives you your astroseismic signal. And it actually turns out that not only do zones affect this picture, but there's been some really interesting work in the course of giant stars where magnetism has been demonstrated to affect the signal as well, and rotation generically affects it as well.
That's really interesting. I didn't realize that you could look at a star's pulsations or variability and make inferences about what was going on seismically in the star's interior. I know that if I looked at the sun, that I would find that, you know, oh, if I'm only looking for 10% variations in brightness, I'm not going to see any. And if I'm only looking for 1% variations in brightness, I'm not going to see any. But if I get sensitive enough where I'm looking for like 0.1% brightness variations in the sun, I am going to see those, that the sun will vary by about 0.1% in brightness in either direction. Do we see relationships between, say, the frequency at which the sun's brightness varies and the frequency of variation and any other property that would allow us to say, oh, there is this type of seismic activity occurring in the sun's interior, or can we rule that out for the sun? What do we see in these stars where we think there is this astroseismic activity versus the ones where we don't?
The application of these seismic techniques to the sun in particular is called helioseismology. And that's a very developed field in its own right. When I'm talking about these applications for stars that are not the sun, it's currently very hard to do, and this is a very involved discipline. But there are correlations essentially between as you said, the frequency of maximum power and the other kinds of oscillations that you get. So you get whole mode spectrum of these oscillations, and that pattern, that imprinted pattern, tells you a lot about the structure of the star, and in detail what that pattern is, that little fingerprint, will be modified by a lot of these interior processes, such as rotation, such as the size of different zones. And it's in fitting these fingerprints that that astrophysicists and astroseismologists in particular are able to get this peek into the interior of stars.
I see. So just like here on Earth, where you see and hear the reflections of seismic waves propagating through and bouncing off of the different layers, that gives us a picture of Earth's interior. you're saying by looking at these variation behaviors coming from the surfaces of these stars and looking at the signals that do and don't get out, we can sort of infer an interior model of these stars, including convective zones, radiative zones, relative sizes, just by seeing what does and doesn't propagate out of the stars that are seismically active that we see.
Yes, and it's still quite, even though there has been quite remarkable and stunning results coming from this field of astroseismology, it's still kind of a field in its infancy because a lot of these approaches are very hard to do. And so we don't actually have coverage over the entire HR diagram. In fact, when we generally think of astroseismology in the field, we think about the applications of these two very inflated stars like the giants, for which you can actually see observable detections right now. But a key part of this approach is that astroseismologists have been trying to push this to stars that are smaller and stars for which the signals are a bit harder to distinguish.
A lot of times when I hear people say that there is a field that is developing but still in its infancy, what they're trying to tell me is, don't trust anything coming from this field. It might all still be crap. But other times when I hear people telling me this field is still in its infancy, it means, well, for the first time, we're finally able to figure some things out. And if I were a young person who was interested in individual stars and sort of the connection between the interior and the exterior of a star, this would be a wonderful field to go into because there is a lot of room for this field to grow, and we will have better sets of observations coming in the coming years, meaning that this is going to become a much more data-driven field in the future, and young people listening to this should consider going into that field.
Right, exactly. I think it's much more the latter case. In fact, a lot of these astroseismic inferences are the best picture of how individual stars' interior structures are. This is a very powerful technique, and it's actually quite a unique technique within solar astrophysics. And some of the implications that come out of astroseismic studies have been very insightful matching our models to observation. So it's a very powerful technique, and it's receiving a lot of support right now from not only the community but also from international planned missions as well. In particular, the NASA Roman mission will be excellent for astroseismology, and so will the Plato mission. And astroseismology is one of the tools that we as stellar astrophysicists dispel, I think, the notion that stars are these unchanging, very simple objects, and that stellar astrophysics is solved. In fact, one of the things that we are taught in stellar astrophysics courses, at least I was taught, is that stellar astrophysics is a case in astrophysics where the field is essentially solved. And no, we're finding right now that, in fact, in a lot of these stars, the details matter, and the details matter a lot more than people previously expected. And some of these effects are actually important enough to materially affect the evolution of the star over long nuclear timescales.
I see. So Is the reason observatories like Habitable Worlds and Plato will be so powerful for probing this is because they will be capable of observing large numbers of stars, not just at a snapshot in time, but over time scales where you can measure their variability very well at a variety of different wavelengths, and then come back to them later and observe them again and see if their variability pattern has changed at all. Is that the specific types of observations that you would need to sort of measure and detect how these stars are evolving?
So I think you're hitting upon another really interesting question, which is that people know that the activity of the sun changes. And this is very well known. That there's a cyclic variation in the solar activity. The sun occasionally has periods of maximum sunspot coverage, and that at times it reaches a minimum. And there have been preliminary studies where we've tracked individual stars for long periods of time, and that we actually have the ability to view these cycles on other stars. But we really only know about the mean trends, and we know about the mean deviations in activity generally for stars. So we don't really have a fleshed out picture of how those stars change in their activity as well, and how those changes in activity might affect those stars and those systems as well.
I see. So is this basically talking about graduating stellar astrophysics and astroseismology and star spot monitoring? Is it basically graduating it from, well, we have a few stars that we've kind of looked at with, you know, cruder instruments, to now we're really going to get into the details and we're going to be doing true high cadence time domain astronomy on some of these stars over very long time periods, and that's going to be what teaches us about what is the actual connection between their star spot cycles and their, you know, basically everything else we can observe, like stellar output and variability and how these things change over time?
Oh, yeah. The data is exquisite, coming in from these large catalog surveys. And so there's a real opportunity in astronomy right now for any interested party to really dive in, because the amount of data that we're getting is large enough at this point that there's a lot of really interesting little puzzles that can be solved with these data that tell you something really interesting about physical processes within these stars that have wide implications for stellar evolution, for the planets around the stars, for our understanding of the physics of, you know, how fluids work. And to kind of relate to that, I'd like to kind of mention some work that was done by Jen von Saters. To relate to this, I'd like to kind of talk about this really interesting puzzle which was recently solved, and really actually appears in these large data sets, which is this relates to in interactions. This is a instability that occurs in the outer envelopes of some of these stars, the mixing and the burning processes within stars, that there appears to be a little glitch in a period of evolution, which was termed kind of the convective kissing instability. And this has to do with these complicated interactions between mixing and burning, which occur in great detail. And it turns out that these actually have observational effects as well. So people have discovered these gaps relating to these instabilities in large survey data that came from the Gaia satellite. And in fact, this is a very stunning example of how the detailed physics within stellar models can actually tell us, can actually be observed in large populations, and actually shows up as this really interesting little instability zone. And this is all very current work.
So if I were someone who was interested in saying, I want to understand how stars evolve from an early active sunspot-rich or starspot-rich fast-rotating phase to a more stable, potentially low variability phase, what are the details that you think need to be uncovered, right? If we wanted to say, I understand that stars are born with all sorts of different masses, rotation rates, all sorts of properties, and I want to understand how stars evolve from the ones that are originally fast rotators with lots of sunspots, how do they evolve to the more quiet, mature phase of their lives? What are the things I need to be studying and looking at and measuring right now?
So to answer your question, first we kind of have to understand what stellar ages are. So we have to be able to say for a given star how old it is, because whether it's a truly an old star or actually a very young star changes our idea of what the interior structure ought to be, and it's required in order to test all these different models. But it's not easy to get ages for stars. In fact, a lot of ages for stars depend on matching their temperature and their luminosity to standard models. But as I mentioned before, the ring pull of radius inflation is that some stars are actually inflated, and that changes the relationship between their temperature and luminosity and shifts them along these diagrams. So that may be the standard models for the so-called isochronal dating might be perturbed by magnetism.
Interesting. So does that mean one of the things we need to do, it might not be the only thing, but one of the things we need to do is we've just recently identified that this is a new potential source of systematic errors in determining the ages of stars, and we need to be able to successfully take that into account, or we're going to draw biased conclusions.
A lot of these young stars, and a lot of these young stars are in fact very magnetic and very heavily spotted, and this is assumed to affect their and if in detail a lot of these young stars are very spotted and magnetic, and these actually produce strong deviations in standard models and the magnetic models that are used to model these stars. And it is, as you said, a significant systematic in the ages for a lot of these systems. So this, even isochronal aging is affected by systematics in the activity levels of stars, which haven't been previously dealt with in a systematic fashion. So in fact, our understanding of stellar ages may be perturbed by the consideration of magnetism in detail.
And is this a bigger effect for the lower mass stars than it is for the more massive stars?
So yes, in general, the low mass stars are more active for longer. And if you're fitting any given population, more of your stars in the low mass end are going to be affected by these magnetic processes. And so right now we're seeing the strongest evidence in populations for these low mass stars being significantly fit better by these magnetic models. And because age is such an important piece to the puzzle, because we need an age to investigate what the stages of stellar evolution are, especially in the very young systems where we need the ages to even say what phases happen first in the star formation process. Because these ages are so important and they're at best an indirectly probed by some of these different measurement techniques, we really need all the different age diagnostics that we have to properly understand what the star's properties are and how we can match a given stellar model onto that particular star's observations. And so some other techniques that have been proposed in the literature have been to look at a star's rotation. So isochronal aging, mapping a star's luminosity and temperature to its age, does not work.
It sounds like what you're trying to tell me is we have a lot of ways we use to measure the ages of stars. And if we use the traditional, you know, broad stroke elephant gun we use to say, oh yeah, you just look at these properties of the star and it tells you how old it is. If we do that, naive thing for these stars, especially the stars that are young, rapid rotators, and have lots of star spots on them, we're not going to get the right result. We're going to get completely biased results. So one of the things we really have to look at carefully is when we want to determine the age of the star, what's the proper prescription for doing that? And there are many different approaches to that that may apply under different circumstances, but we're absolutely sure that using the traditional one is going to give us wildly wrong answers for these classes of stars.
And with independent age estimates, we might hope to actually calibrate and calibrate these age relationships and be able to test whether our stellar models are actually getting a better solution for some of the stars. And so some of the other age estimates that have been applied to these stars are simply to look at the stellar angular momentum. And actually this approach, which is called gyrochronology, is sensitive to different age regimes than the standard isochronal aging. In particular, it can give you a lot of information about the age of a star for these low mass stars for which an isochronal age might be very hard to get or basically impossible to get because the variation of luminosity and temperature for those stars on the main sequence do not change a whole lot. And so people use gyrochronology to get at these ages for stars in a different manner. And this might be very useful to actually understanding the evolution of some of these populations of stars. But the really interesting piece of this is that I'm particularly involved in, is that not only do we look at stars in terms of their global properties, their temperature and their luminosity, and how these might affect the stellar age and our stellar models, not only do we look at rotation as well to get these gyrochronal ages, but there might also be some power, some signal in the magnetic activity of these stars, the so-called magnetochronology approach that is now starting to become possible for large samples of stars because of some of the techniques that were developed.
I see. So are you suggesting that, yes, you have the traditional stellar isochrones that we've been using since, you know, all of the 20th century at least, and then we have the newer sort of rotation rate methods of chronology that can be informative to us, but now we're also adding magnetic field behavior in there as a way of determining the ages of these stars. And, you know, it's like many things, different methods of measuring anything are more precise or less useful in different regimes of a star's life. So depending on the properties of the star, yeah, using the isochrone might be totally appropriate. Using the gyrorotational rate might be appropriate. Or, as is emerging now, and you're helping lead, using the magnetic properties of the star, that could also be another independent and, in some cases, the most useful way of measuring a star's age.
Yeah, so, and also by doing this, we might be able to get information about these large populations of stars and deliver on the promise of doing precision stellar astrophysics and really starting to understand the different physical processes which are relevant for determining the evolution of these systems, not only the stars, but also their companion planets. But there's also the promise that with all these different techniques and all these different lines of evidence, which we can model stars better, we might find stars that significantly deviate from standard relations. And understanding these deviations, whether it's something really weird is happening on the star due to binary interactions, some altered history of maybe the star ate up a planet or something like that. Being able to see it in these large populations and being able to actually identify these systems for further study is also a feasible output from this kind of detailed look at these large populations.
I mean, that's always true, right? You look at something and you say, okay, in general, here's how objects work and here's where they fall on, you know, this line or this relationship between these two parameters. And hey, look over here. Here are some things that are outliers. You always want to go study those and sort of get to the bottom of that puzzle. You know, listening to you talk about this field, I'm reminded very much of Lord Kelvin and something he wrote, which is he said, "I often say that when you can measure what you are speaking about and express it in numbers, you know something about it. But when you cannot measure it, when you cannot express it in numbers, your knowledge is of a meager and unsatisfactory kind. It may be the beginning of knowledge, but you have scarcely in your thoughts advanced to the stage of science, whatever the matter may be." And it sounds like what you're talking to us about is we have known that, you know, yeah, we have some basic broad strokes ways of saying this is how old your star is. But we are now seeing, you know, there are these classes of stars, which may include the most common type of star in the universe, these M-dwarf stars, that the method we've been using is not reliable. It's not reliable for these stars. But now we are developing these other methods that may be reliable and just maybe for the first time can give us a better window into certain details of stellar evolution than we've ever had before. It's got to be pretty exciting for you to be on the frontiers of uncovering that.
Oh, yeah. And it's extremely exciting because a lot of these ideas were developed decades ago, maybe 30, 40 years ago in the field. And the data is only now coming out from these space satellites, and these ground-based surveys, which are allowing us to test some of these hypotheses. I think it's been really rewarding seeing the amount of opportunities and the amount of research interest in each of these possibilities, and also in the development of these significantly more detailed prescriptions, which may give us a better understanding of how we got here and the processes that were necessary for our existence.
You know, I think this is wonderful. You're basically talking about understanding what makes the stable conditions we have and enjoy here on Earth, what creates those conditions and also what fails to create those conditions around other stellar and planetary systems in the universe. It's really interesting to think that we've had all of this focus on planetary science and the hunt for inhabited worlds and extraterrestrial life, and we have been overlooking this really important property of stars that may be either a deal breaker or an enabler for having even the possibility of life arising on world around it. Lyra, I want to thank you for such an interesting conversation. And for sharing with us really truly cutting edge science from stellar astronomy on astroseismology, on dating stars, and in particular at looking at the interplay of magnetism, their interiors, convection, and what we can observe here on the surface. Before I let you go, do you have any final thoughts you would like to share with our listeners out there?
I think often in astrophysics, we grapple with the idea that perhaps a lot of the things that we talk about on this program or a lot of the things that we work on in our day-to-day lives have no real connection to the world around us. I think a lot of the questions that we ask ourselves are related to some of these deep questions and relate very powerfully to our culture and to our identity as people. I think the process of undergoing science, it creates a lot of opportunities, and it's an opportunity for us to represent the best of ourselves, to create the kinds of societies that we want to see and create the kinds of representation and opportunities and equality and justice that we want to see in the world. And so I think when I think of the kinds of intellectual developments in science, I also think of the community, and I'm very grateful in particular for the community for supporting a lot of my work and for giving me a lot of opportunities to develop some of the ideas some of the ideas that I've mentioned on today's program. And I want to say to everyone who is looking for opportunities to reach out, and that a lot of this work is really quite tractable, and there's quite a lot of data to dig through, and it's a very rewarding process to work in this very positive community, and to develop ideas that I think will be relevant to us not only on an intellectual level, but deeply on a spiritual level and also culturally.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. This was Dr. Lyra Tao, and she is a VITA postdoctoral fellow at Vanderbilt. And, you know, this has been really, I think, a wonderful discussion about some of, you know, it may seem to some of you like these are just details about stars that don't have anything to do with our own. But on the other hand, these are also looking at important details about how did we come to be? How do other star systems, planetary systems, and maybe even life forms arise or not arise depending on what's going on elsewhere in the universe? This whole enterprise of science is the process of investigation, and it's not only open to anyone who wants to have those opportunities and pursues them, but these stories are a cosmic part of us all. We all came about from the same laws of physics, the same sets of atoms that lived and died inside a variety of stars. And now, here on Earth, We're all sharing the same environment, and we have the same 13.8 billion year cosmic history behind us. And elsewhere in the universe, in the Milky Way and beyond, other stars, stellar systems, planets, and possibly even life forms are piecing together the same version of the cosmic story as it applies to them. So thank you, Dr. Lyra Tsao. Thank you to Avenues the World School for sponsoring our podcast. And thanks to you out there for listening. The Starts With a Bang podcast is only made possible through the generous donations of our Patreon supporters. And I'd like to thank everyone who supports us at the $5 a month level and above. Thanks go to Chad Marler, Jeff Bonwick, Lainey Chuist, Rob Hansen, Samir Kumar, Tim Graham, Aaron Weiss, Chris Jakutas, Dominic Turpin, John Methot, John Van Balaguyen, Matt Conroe, Pattern Shift, Pete Smoyer, Pierre Franson, C. Green Mango, Stefan Bernegger, William Blair, Amira Sosnick, Andy and Wall, Benish Tech LLC, Brian Terry, David Charney, David Hivitz, David Wallach, George Church, Hirolamo Castaldo, James Franklin, John Kozura, Joseph Dvorak, Kiliopu, Mark Armstrong, Matt Glasser, Patrick Dennis, Pedro Teixeira, Rafael Wojcik, Randall Slimak, Rick DeWitt, Ron Schiffman, Sean Foley, Steve Guderian, Adam Robinson, Adrian Griffiths, Alan Parikh, Andres Chovanec, Arnulfo Zepeda, Ben Head, Bob Shire, Brainwise, Brett Minder, Cameron Sowards, Carl Ittings, Casey Haskins, Dan Steelen, Dana Bridges, David Taschioni, David Wolf, Diana Nevins, Dwayne Williams, Eric Zetterbaum, Flo, Fraser Kane, Glenn McDavid, Ira Cohen, James Bryson Hyatt, James Nance, James Page, Jason Luttrell, Jason McCampbell, Javier Zazo, Catherine S., Kelly Kudrick, Lockwood Carlson, Mark Bergeron, Mark Bloor, Mark Langston, Matt Reno, Michael Hall, Michael Prochota, Michael Sabuto, Naked Bunny with a Whip, Nathan Hannon, Neil Flood, Nick Winland, Owen Mann, Pam Harris, Paul Lester, Pavel Zizelski, Phil Hallenborg, Philip Francis, Rich Weigel, Richard Schwartz, Ron Lyle, Rushi Shaw, Steve Nordhoff, Stuart Lending, Tom Van Scotter, Tomas All, Tomas Walgren, Weller Tractor Salvage, Wayne Pierkarski, William Vanden Heuvel, and Young Co. S. Thanks to all of you for tuning in, and we'll see you back here next time for more Starts With a Bang.